here to give you any solutions to all of these questions. I do hope that I can give you a little better insight into some of the issues that are part of the problems of these issues in medicine. The insights that I can give you are not the ones that you read every day in your newspapers, which I think really make sometimes the problem more complicated and more difficult to deal with because of the shallowness of their looking into the problems. Today we're going to talk about the money matter, and of course I'm just going to speak for maybe about 20 minutes and tell you some facts and tell you some case histories of actual patients that I deal with, which I think are good good examples of some of the problems, some of the good and the bad points of our present system. And then I'm going to throw the floor open here and hopefully stimulate a discussion about this thing, and maybe we can all leave here a little better educated about the thing. First of all, the biggest fact I think to bring out is that 10% of our gross national product nowadays is being spent for medical care and in medical related areas. This is the highest percentage of a gross national product of any nation in the world. Question is, what are we buying with that 10%? If the product is real good, then maybe it's worth the expenditures. If it's not so good, then maybe we need to look at the money that is being spent. The country which is right next to us in expenditure of gross national product is Sweden. And I think if I were to choose a system of medical care, I would personally think that the Swedish model is probably the best model in the world. Now, I'm going to make that statement, and I hope later on you'll challenge me to perhaps fill in the details on that. I don't think the Swedish system would necessarily work in this country for a number of reasons, but I think that the Swedish system right now is giving the best medical care to their population of any country in the world. The next country that even approaches 10% of gross national product is probably France, and they do a pretty good job there. I don't think their system is better than ours. If I were to rate a system, I would say that perhaps the U.S. is perhaps number two and France number three. If you want to go on down, then you go to Great Britain, which spends 5% of their gross national product on medical care, and I think they have a whole lot of problems in their system. And if you want to explore that, I can tell you about that. The United States easily leads the world in new technology and in new developments in terms of therapeutics for the field of medicine. And I think that I can say that we bring this technology to our people in greater numbers than almost any other country in the world except for Sweden. I think the Swedish system really dispenses that technology out the best to all segments of society, and we obviously have problems in our society with this. If you look at the quality of care in the United States, it ranges from the best all the way down to, a lot of people, politicians like to say the worst. I won't say it's the absolute worst, but it is pretty low. If you want to look on a statistical basis of how we rank in the world, the latest figures would show that we rank fifth as far as maternal deaths related to childbirth. We rank ninth as far as infant mortality. We rank seventh as far as life expectancy for females in our population. And we rank 18th for life expectancy for males in our population. These statistics, though, I think are very misleading, because they're like comparing apples and oranges with different societies, because the society itself determines an awful lot of these kind of statistics of the life expectancy of the male and the female, for instance, and also of the infant mortality and the maternal mortality.
The statistics were best or worst? I mean, you know, you said seventh, ninth, in number or in not the number. How do you interpret those figures? Did I miss it? You know, we're in seventh place.
We're in seventh place. In other words, we're the best in the world.
Would be number one?
Would be number one, yeah. In terms, they would have the lowest infant mortality. And there are, in other words, six countries ahead of us as far as life expectancy for females. In other words, their women live longer than ours. And they're...
How many countries total?
Out of how many total countries? Well, they don't... If you look at the small African nation, for instance, they don't even rank them because there's not a statistical way that they can rank them. They don't really have any type of a census procedure or any way of obtaining statistics in those countries. Usually it's about 100 countries, and usually we're talking about the most industrialized and civilized countries of the world when we're talking about these figures. I think the actual number that they take is about, there's about 80 countries altogether in the world that are actually included in the statistics.
And you're also saying that they're misleading and that each country statistics are based on their own?
Yeah, statistics are based on their own, you know, in terms of their own population, and they don't take into account other factors which affect. A good example of that would be in the United States with our life expectancy for males. The major cause of death in our society for young men under 30 years of age is accidents. We're talking about car accidents, drownings, falls, this kind of thing. If we took at the major cause of death in some other country, accidents would probably not be it. And what I'm saying is that the accidents are a product of our society. For instance, the car. How many societies do do a large part of the population that's under 30 years of age drive automobiles and therefore are exposed to our high car accident rate?
So the culture, the way of life.
Yeah, the culture that we have has a great deal of bearing on that figure there. So that's why I say it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges.
What was the infant mortality rating? Did you give that?
Ninth. This has taken a considerable drop in the last few years.
What do you mean by infant mortality? Those born in childbirth or?
Those live births that die before 2 years of age. Children who die before 2 years of age. From all causes.
We spend the most money in health care, yet there are eight nations that have a better survival rate.
That's right. And I can give some explanation for that later on. Now, if we take a look at the 10% of our gross national product that we spend for medical care, then you have to kind of put that in perspective also. We spend about 35 to 37% of our gross national product for defense. We spend about 5% of our gross national product for alcohol and tobacco. So perhaps that gives you a little bit of an idea of how that 10% ranks in there. 85% of our people have some type of medical coverage. Now, this is not saying that they have complete medical coverage for every type of illness, and especially catastrophe illness, but 85% of our population is covered either by welfare or Medicaid or Medicare or by private insurance. And so there is a 15% that really stands out. They have no means of covering the cost of medical care in this country. And this is a problem area that we need to look at in terms of the future in dealing with this 15%. There are some people who are only partially insured, however, that are included in that 85% who really are also a problem area and that we need to take a look at. What are we going to do about them? Let me give you an example of what I think is the best of our medical care system and why I think it works real well in many cases. And I'd like to take the case of my own father, who's a railway conductor. About 7 years ago, he passed out while doing some work in the backyard and was taken to the doctor, and he had a long known a heart murmur relating to an episode of rheumatic fever as a child. He had been in good health all of his life, had never had any hospitalizations or surgeries or any problems. He had taken prophylactic penicillin since childhood to ward off the possible scourge of infection that may infect his damaged heart. He was studied with what we call coronary angiogram of left and right heart cath, and it was determined that his mitral valve had been so badly damaged and over the years had scarred so badly that it was tightly constricted and not enough blood was getting through the valve, that when he was exercising he didn't get enough blood to the head, and therefore he fainted. He was told that there was only a 50-50 chance that he would live one more year without some type of surgery being done. So after a period of contemplation and decision making on his, he did submit to surgery and had the replacement of a valve, which at a cost of around $11,000. This was totally covered by his railway insurance, all except for about $300 worth. He returned to work within 6 months and continued to work until he retired approximately a year ago. And he now is enjoying his retirement. And he certainly has a life expectancy that goes on for 10 years plus at this particular point. His heart at this point is probably better than it has ever been since he was a child and was first afflicted with the rheumatic fever. I think he's very satisfied with what our medical system has done for him and certainly has no complaints about it. Let's take one of our problem cases, though. I, being a practitioner in the state of Washington, I deal with a lot of Washington statistics. Over 50% of the budget for welfare in the state of Washington goes for medical care. Over 50% of that 50% goes for the care of 4% of the people who are using the medical services on Medicaid. And this is what I'd like to tell you the next case about. Not too long ago, a 57-year-old lady was admitted in shock to the local hospital, and since I was on call that day for the emergency room, I was called to start her care. This lady was a known alcoholic who had been admitted at least once or twice a year for many years with complications related to her alcoholism. She had been found at home on the floor of her apartment, where she had probably lain for probably 3 days out cold and had gone into shock. She had large decubitus ulcers or pressure ulcers on her back and on her buttocks, and there were actually lice crawling in and out of them. She was in shock with no measurable blood pressure, probably because of the fact that she had developed an infection in this time which had spread into the bloodstream. She was admitted into the coronary care unit and given chemicals to raise her blood pressure, antibiotics were started, all of the life-saving techniques that we use. She ended up having to have kidney dialysis to be put on a respirator to breathe for her, and really required a great deal of the technology that we can have nowadays. She was in that intensive care unit for approximately 1 month. After that time, when she was out of shock completely and relatively back to a normal health, she then was moved to another area of the hospital, and we began the extensive skin grafting to cover these large areas of the body where she had these pressure ulcers and cleaned them up. This took approximately 2 more months before she was then at this point ready to discharge from the hospital and go to a extended care facility. She was recommended to go into an alcohol treatment program, but refused to go at this particular point. The cost of her care was something like $70,000, not counting the cost to the doctors. This is one of the 4% of patients who use up half of the money which is spent for welfare. And I think illustrates one of the real problems in our care system. our system is not perfect, and there are a lot of suggestions right now for how to improve it. And these changes are going to be made, and I hope that they're made with intelligence. I don't feel that the system right now does not need to be changed. I think something has to be done about it. People do have a real worry about being wiped out from an illness, and I think we should remove that worry from them. Right now, Senator Long is a big proponent of a catastrophe illness bill, which I think I see a real need for. Basically, his bill says that if you expend over $2,000 towards your medical care in 1 year's time, then the government will pick up all the costs thereafter. This is estimated to add about $5 billion to our present medical costs to give this kind of coverage. President Carter has really recently come forth with his proposal, which is basically quite modest in a lot of ways, but has a lot of other features added to it, mainly care, optimal care for children up to a certain age, optimal care of pregnancy through pregnancy, also trying to take care of some of the loopholes in our present system for the older people who have nothing but Medicare and Social Security and get caught in our system. His cost is estimated to be about $30 billion added to our present system. Senator Kennedy has his program forth, which is essentially total medical care for the population from birth to death, and it's estimated that it will cost around $60 billion on top of our present medical care system. Let's throw it open now and ask some questions and make some points. And
who determines that 4% that gets the benefits? How do you decide, for instance, that woman would get that much of it?
There is no system set up for limiting how much one person may take of the benefits, this particular point. This is one of the things that I think we should be thinking about, because I can tell you case after case of people who do this kind of thing, have multiple admissions during the year for reasons of alcoholism, drug addiction, these kind of things, and the system pays for them, patches them up, puts them back out on the street to go right back to their former habits.
In the, discouraging.
I understand in the Veterans Hospital treatment that they have some program where that if the doctor recommends, or not recommends, but be a stronger term, his diagnosis is for a certain treatment, that if the patient goes against that treatment, that there's some way that they can say, well, then the rest of your VA coverage is in jeopardy.
I don't know that that exists. That has been talked about, but I've never seen that, in fact. I have worked in a veterans hospital in Houston where they had a 1,700-bed psychiatric ward, and 600 beds of it was filled with alcoholics. And the alcoholics, there was, at that time when I worked there, if a man was hospitalized for 20 days out of the month, then he received one full month's benefits in terms of pay. And it was a routine thing that these people would come in, stay for 20 days, collect their check, and leave, and go out and go back to the street and to the bottle to show up back again the next month. To start their another 20-day sojourn to earn their money again. And there were 600 beds of 1,700 that were tied up with these kind of people.
I guess, of course, a person I know who was in Portland, a VA hospital, and he decided that if he was getting ready for some kind of surgery, and there is something that they hadn't fully explored yet. And he was far physically, other than that one headache, was doing fine. And he wanted to go home. The doctor said, if you go home, you go AMA. And then you won't have any benefits. So that kind of situation.
I don't know that actually exists or not.
He said it did, so.
I guess I'm a little disturbed by what I hear you saying. And it's almost as though alcoholism is not a disease. And like if that's the cause, then somehow they don't deserve that much money for treatment. And I know that's maybe not what you're saying, that's what I'm hearing. And I wonder if the case was a person who had high blood pressure and prescribed treatment was to go on medication for the rest of their life. And they just decided they didn't want to take the medication. As a result, what, a stroke, a heart attack, something. And let's say the stroke, because that can be massive, costly treatment too. How do you decide between the two like that, where both of them seem to be just not taking responsibility for their treatment? Both of them can be very high cost. I agree on one hand that there are ways that costs get out of control and something has to be done.
No, I don't have that answer for you. And that's what I'm trying to pose to you. What can we do about people who will not take any responsibility for their health? And yet, when they have blown their health, then it becomes society's responsibility. I don't know.
Because if you took it to extremes, you could say people who refuse to participate in exercise programs are being irresponsible too.
I don't think you can do it in a negative manner that way. I think you can approach it from a positive manner, though. And I'd like to see things such as, for instance, a tax on the cigarettes placed to cover the cost to our society of illness related to cigarettes, a tax on alcohol to cover the cost to our society related to that. I would also like to see people, if it was possible, when you obtained your insurance, if you were 20% overweight, if you had poor health habits, that you paid more for your insurance than somebody who didn't. This would be a positive motivating factor for some people to adopt better health habits, I think.
So since you're talking about preventive.
Yeah, I'm interested in preventative medicine. It's a lot easier to take care of these things beforehand.
I am too, but I don't see medicine as a whole being as interested in preventative as in treatment.
Well, this is one of the charges that I think is being bannered around, and I don't think it's that anybody has really listened to medicine about that, you know, because that's what my whole thing is about. That's what I was trained for, and that's what I'm training other doctors for right now. And that's what the big swing in medicine right now is for. I don't know whether you realize it or not, but the government, with the money that they have allocated for medical education, has put it all into primary care lately. This has been going on now for about 6 years. There was a lot of gnashing of teeth when this happened, because that meant that the Department of Surgery and all of these other departments had to come to the primary care departments for their allocation of money. And so we're training many more family physicians and internists and primary care doctors now, and we're putting less emphasis on surgery and all of the subspecialty areas. And we're talking more and more about preventative medicine.
I have two questions. Could you talk on why we have such a high infant maternal mortality rate, and also could you talk some about the Swedish system?
The first one, the high infant mortality rate, relates to our population. We're a melting pot population. People from many diverse countries have come to this country, and we've set up little cultures within our big culture. And these little cultures have their ways of dealing with pregnancy and with children. I did my training in Houston, Texas. Houston had a tremendously high infant mortality rate there, and the reason was because people did not believe in prenatal medical care there. And we had people constantly being brought to the hospital, pregnant women who were in the throes of what we call toxemia of pregnancy, or who were very malnourished, or many, many other medical problems, which later, if it didn't end up in their demise, at least ended up with the demise of their children.
Are you talking about general population or segments of Houston?
Segments of Houston more, you know. And this, of course, this had a lot to do with poverty. My obstetrics training was done in a 600-bed charity hospital that was nothing but taking care of the poverty population of Houston. And even though we had clinics for these women, there was probably only 20 or 30% of the population, of the pregnant population in the ghettos and in the area, that ever took advantage of our prenatal clinic care. Most of the great majority of them came in labor and stayed the time that it took to deliver their baby and recover them, and then left the hospital. And so that is a bad time to be dealing with to head off any problems in that pregnancy for that child. If the child did survive that period of time, then the child was facing a great period of time where there was no well child care either, because the well child clinics were not well attended either. And we couldn't get people to take immunizations and to just accept the normal everyday medical care that you and I know is really indicated for young children. I think that is one of the big things in our country. And I think this really contrasts with Sweden, where they have a relatively homogeneous population, pretty much one culture there, and medical care, proper medical care throughout life is a stressed and an accepted part of that medical culture. You don't deal with those kind of problems in Sweden. People there do get prenatal care. Children do get well child care. And I think that really makes the big difference in the contrast.
How is that encouraged there as opposed to discouraged here?
I don't think it's discouraged here, really, at least not by the medical profession. There are groups in this country that do discourage medical care. We all know that there are certain religions that do it, but there are also cultures that do it. The ghetto population in Houston, there definitely was a discouraging trend in that particular area, but certainly not by the medical community. An awful lot of the pregnancies were out of wedlock situations, and this had an awful lot of bearing on it.
Did the Houston community have a medical profession apart from the hospital? Were there doctors that actually practiced in the
community? Oh, yes.
Many?
Huh? Many?
Yeah.
I would say that there was a good physician population relation there, ratio. There is always a problem of getting doctors to go into ghettos.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bad place to practice for many, many reasons. And that certainly was one of the problems I would share in Houston.
What percentage of the population really need the best of medical care, like the woman you cited with the ulcers and that kind of thing? Is it like 5%?
About 5%.
Yeah, so it's not on... So her absorption of the expenses really isn't out of line.
No.
Because that's the way it's spent anyhow.
No. Mm-hmm. Except that particular segment of the population really is taking an exorbitant amount of the funds.
Is it also true that a large part of the cost of medical care in the total package is because America, and I don't think the doctors have done this, I think the citizenry have done it, that in our country we demand high-paid medical attention for stuff that really doesn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in an emergency room for a long time, and a patient would come in with an obviously broken leg, but they couldn't be sent to X-ray till the doctor looked at it and said, you've got to go to X-ray. A nurse would know that and could send them on, but the high-paid technician had to say, send them on. Then the X-ray came back, and the nurse could tell, as I could, it was a broken leg. You know, but the doctor had to look at that X-ray before the next stage took place. So we just demand doctors and hospitals for a lot of stuff that don't require doctors and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a population expectation has made that high cost. Doctors haven't asked for that.
Don't you think it's the increased number of malpractice suits and stuff to make that? I mean, they're afraid to make the decision. The doctor has to do it because otherwise they can bring a suit.
Well, that is part of the problem, but I don't think it's a great problem, and I think it's pretty well underhand right now. Let's go back to the Swedish thing, because I think the Swedish thing may be more illustrative of what the ideal system would be. In Sweden, as I say, they have a homogeneous population. The population is very health-minded. They take advantage of the health care that is available and intend to maintain a high level of health. The important thing, I think, in Sweden is that they have the medical resources allocated on a uniform basis throughout the country. Everybody has their basic family physician or primary care physician, which is the first level of care for them. No matter what their illness is, they go to that first level of care. And as I do in my practice and as I teach, I can take care of 85 to 90% of the illnesses of all the people that come to me at that particular level. I can meet their needs, get them over it, and get them back to work. That 10% that I can't take care of, I can at least recognize where my limitations are and get them to the next level of care where they need to be seen. So the secondary level. And in Sweden, that secondary level is spread uniformly all over the country. It's very much like a pyramid system. On the lower level, we have the primary care doctors with all of the population infusing in there. On the secondary level, the pyramid narrows, and there are less of the secondary doctors. And then we go to the very highest, or the tertiary level care, which is even less of these type of people and less of this kind of facility spread all over the country. In the whole of Sweden, there are, if you've been reading your newspapers, the latest big thing that the politicians are throwing around, and everybody's throwing around, is the CAT scanner. This is a particular device which is really a tremendous breakthrough. It allows us to see what's going inside of the skull or in an area of the body without doing any type of an invasive procedure. It's not, there is no complication or possibility of risk to the patient in undergoing this procedure. This particular device has helped us to not have to do many, many tests that were dangerous and very uncomfortable to the patient. In all of Sweden, there are 17 CAT scanners. In the city of Cleveland, I think there are 17 CAT scanners. In Spokane, there are 6. In Washington, D.C., there are 25. This is, I think, really illustrates the problem in our country. We don't have this pyramid system developed in this country where people can feed in on one level and most of them are taken care of on that particular level and sent back to their homes well, and those who can't be taken care of on that level are shunted up the line to treatment centers that are developed to take care of that particular level of care. Every city in America has to have the whole shooting match. We all want to be taken care of everything in our particular city. We don't want to have to travel several hundred miles to the medical center and have something done.
Isn't part of that due to the fact that we live in an economic society where it's to the advantage of the companies making those machines and that kind of thing to sell more? That medicine, in some ways, is a profit-oriented business. Mm-hmm.
Well, it is in a sense, but this is part of our place, of our country. I give you an example of that. In the city of Spokane, we had two CAT scanners. Right now, in order for a hospital to add a piece of machinery, which costs more than $150,000, I think it is, you have to go through a very complicated hearing system and with a certificate of need to be granted by the local health organization, regional health organization. In the dear old state of Washington, the state medical society got together and lobbied to make physicians exempt from that process. They've said that, you know, for a new physician, for instance, coming in and setting up in a community, it would probably cost more than $150,000 for him to set up, so why should he have to go through this complicated hearings and paperwork and stuff to set up? So they exempted physicians. Well, that was the real loophole, because then radiology groups who were connected to hospitals that didn't have the CAT scanner went out and purchased the CAT scanner themselves and set them up in the physician's office building, which was right next door to the hospital.
I understand they cost about $500,000.
No, they cost over $1 million. The $500,000 one is just the little one for just doing the head, and now we've got to have the big one that does the whole body.
Well, I have been used in London, Missouri. I knew they just had one there at the time, a year and a half ago.
It's a tremendous breakthrough. It really is. It's technology at its best, and it really has allowed us to make diagnosis and to do things for people that's unbelievable, but it's coming at a tremendous cost to our society also.
They're saying that there's more than we need if they would disperse the
money. Oh, right, yeah, yeah. The city of Spokane, the place that you really need a CAT scanner, for instance, for the head is in a hospital that's going to be handling major trauma that's coming in off of the highway or this kind of thing. Now, not all hospitals are going to be handling major trauma. We need some system of designating a hospital as a place where major trauma will be taken to.
If our system is wrong, how can it be changed? How could you get America to get into a different model?
Some of it starts right in the universities. Mm-hmm. The competition and the pride of having your own thing and not willing to share. Even Christians aren't too good at sharing, and the universities where hierarchy is so important. Each have to have their own.
Mm-hmm. That's part of it.
The county laws would probably be the only way that people would, in other words, if somebody in Washington would think of it, well, this system is the way it would work better, isn't it? And you mentioned three people, Long and Kennedy and Carter, that have propositions. Are any of these propositions that are being thrown out now dealing with these issues?
Not this issue, certainly. There is presently and now, and looks like there will be passage before the end of this session, a law which will apply this certificate of need thing to all medical facilities, including physicians, which I think is going to stop this proliferation of CAT scanners greatly.
But does the certificate of need process work? I work in a large hospital, and we've gone through this process, and this is a case where the hospital bought the CAT scanner, not the doctor. I think our hospital was the first or the second one in the city to get one. Now I think there are at least five or six hospitals that have one. And I'm sure they've all gone through the certificate of need process. But what is if they're approved anyway? I mean, who's serving on the committee that approves them is my question. And why have the hospital go through these months of preparation for the certificate of need and they're just approved anyway? Now we're in the process of making a new one because we want a bigger, the newer model because ours is old and everybody else's is
lower, and it's just been rat race, and it just keeps going, and somewhere it's going to stop.
HEW has defined the makeup of the of this committee, this health agency, which determines this, and there has to be a minority of medically related people on that committee. So it's lay people who basically make that decision. And we have an excellent one that in the city of Spokane. Some of my patients are on that thing, and they turned down 3 of the 5 CAT scanners in our city.
Actually, aren't 2 more than enough? Wouldn't 2 be more than enough in Spokane, for instance?
Probably.
You know what I mean? Now, you said about Sweden that they have a medical center. Well, geographically, the United States is much bigger, isn't it, than Sweden?
Oh, yes.
But anyway, so it truly is easier for people to come to a medical center in a small country like Sweden.
Yes, it is.
Than it would be, but yet we could have in special areas. That's what we should have, special areas of our country where, like one in the West that is very good, and then so forth. We could do that, and well, then have this expensive medical equipment just at the place.
We are doing that somewhat, and now, and this is one of the trends that I think is really. Good for the country, in that we used to have open heart medical teams all over the United States, some of which were only doing like 5 operations per month and certainly not keeping up their proficiency. And now we have set more stringent regulations as far as this, and have established probably 10 or 12 major open heart centers across the country now, which I think has been a definite benefit. And I think they could do likewise on this level too.
But I think on the Sweden issue, if I could just bring something, I think, doesn't it go beyond, you know, just this pyramid? Aren't there set policies on treating certain things where we don't have here? Don't they have socialized medicine in Sweden? And because they do, they can have set patterns, you know, in this particular case you do this and such and such.
I don't know if I'm understanding your question right. I don't know whether.
I'll give you an example. Okay?
Yeah, give me an example.
I delivered triplets, and I was taken care of by a Swedish doctor. Mm-hmm. And he went through the patterns of what they did in Sweden for high risk mothers in the third trimester. And I followed it, and I delivered full term. Now, he said that in Sweden, all high risk mothers, this includes multiple births, this includes, you know, any kind of high risk, they automatically follow these little set patterns that he had.
Yeah, they're cared for by upper tier personnel, aren't they? In other words, you wouldn't be cared for on a first level basis if you had a high risk pregnancy, would you?
No, he didn't speak it in those terms, but okay. He just spoke to definite patterns. Well, I work in the hospital, I'm a nurse too, and we have a neonatal center there in the high risk mother area. And we've been trying to reach out into the other parts of the state, Minnesota, to teach them how to pick out a high-risk mother, how to see a high-risk infant, and transfer them to a neonatal center. And this is done in the nursing level. They're going to these areas and teaching. But they're finding that, especially in these out in the middle of nowhere areas, doctors have a certain way of treating pregnancy. And they cannot get beyond the normal care of a normal pregnancy, which does not apply to a high-risk mother. Mm-hmm. So these patterns or these programs that high-risk mothers are put on, they're just not put on these programs, and therefore there's a higher infant mortality.
Right.
And I would think that in a country like Sweden, a doctor wouldn't, you know, he might not be able to say, well, you're a high-risk mother, but I don't want to treat you like that. I'll just treat you like a normal pregnancy. Mm-hmm. You'd have to follow certain patterns.
Yeah, I agree. It would be more structured there, and I think that is one of the benefits of their system. A first-level doctor, a primary care doctor who was dealing with a high-risk patient would, first of all, make the diagnosis that she was high-risk, and then he would be probably bound by regulation, but also by common sense, to move her up the ladder to where she would get the best medical care available to her. in the back.
Then how will American doctors react to the future if we're going in that direction that is more, not only more structured, but also towards socialized medicine? And so what tack is the AMA, for example, with its very powerful lobby, taking towards bills like the one that Senator Kennedy is putting forward? And knowing the general discontent among doctors in other countries with socialized medicine, particularly Britain, how, what's it going to be?
Well, of course, the AMA is taking the tack that they want everything done by private health insurance. Doctors leaving the profession, yes. A lot of the older physicians who for many years have gone fee-for-service and done things their way, if there is much regimentation, this will boost them out of the profession, and I don't think that's necessarily a great loss because I think we're replacing them rapidly with better trained physicians who know their limitations and who are more willing to go along with what they think is the better for the country as a whole and not necessarily just for them.
And how will our taxes go if we have socialized medicine in Sweden? What do people pay in taxes?
Well, Sweden, if they're paying about 9% of their gross national product for medical care, and I think they're getting the highest quality medicine available in the world there, I think that's an acceptable figure, really. When you take a look at everything else, I think 9 or 10% in our country is an acceptable figure. I don't, to me it is. But the specter that we want to avoid in and the way things are going is maybe in 5 years it'll be 15%. And we won't have any better system of medical care in this country than we have right now. And I think that's the problem. And that's what we've got to turn around. Now, I don't think that we can adopt the Swedish system here and be as successful with it as they have been. Our people, I don't think, will take the regimentation perhaps as easily as they did in Sweden, which has been something that's come over many years, you know, and didn't develop overnight. You know, we all like to have our own personal physician that we've built up a relationship over many years. We feel very comfortable with him because he knows us, he's taken care of us for many years, and we're hesitant when we get shunted to somebody else. And in a system like we have, in Sweden, for instance, the mother, you know, and we face this all the time in our country, with a high-risk pregnancy, she doesn't want to be referred off to this other doctor that she doesn't know anything about, even though she can reasonably understand that he will give her a better level of care for her pregnancy. They resist that. Have you run into that? They put the pressure on the doctor and say, oh, doc, I don't want that newfangled medical care. Why don't you stay right here and take care of me? I know that you delivered Mrs. Brown down the street who had twins, and heck, if you can deliver two, you can deliver three. And, you know, they do that.
There's,
well, they're really having lots of problems because of the fact that their medical care system is starved to death, frankly, for money. No new facilities have been built in many, many years. This country would not accept what they do over in there. For instance, we have a lot of charges in this country. There's a lot of unnecessary surgery done in this country. Most of the time, there, and I will say that there is unnecessary surgery being done in this country, but not nearly in the proportion that some people would like to think there is. Because what a lot of people determine or call unnecessary surgery is in comparison to a country like England, where, for instance, a woman who needs a hysterectomy because of profuse bleeding problems may go on a list and be on that list for up to 2 years before she can have her hysterectomy done. A man may have a hernia, which is a problem, and go on a list and be on that list for approximately 2 years before he can get his hernia taken care of. But this is in a system where there's only so much money to go around, and, you know, there's only so many people to do it, and you get on, get your name on the list, and when we've got the money and the time and the bed is open for you, then we'll get you in and take care of that problem. Unless it's a, if you have a dire emergency, then in England you can get right in and you get the best of medical care there. But if you have these common, everyday, what we call elective medical problems, then you're treated by when your number comes up and the facility is open for you.
How much of that is really a shortage of money, though, rather than a matter of priorities?
Well, I think that it is a matter.
I guess I'm saying directly that I wonder how much of the whole problem really gets to be more than just a matter of saying we've got this technology, we have this system we can develop, let's do it, and so on. What we're talking about is real cultural mindsets, broad level on subcultural levels, and that so whole attitudes towards healthcare. We want the best, but to pay the least.
And also, I think you hit on something very basic to our society. We are not a homogeneous society.
That's right.
We are a heterogeneous society. We were set up that way to take the poor, the oppressed from all countries, and we're still doing it. And yet we are a dominant white culture. And we tend, therefore, as a dominant white culture, to place everybody else who isn't white in an inferior position, so that whites dominate the medical schools, they dominate the universities, they dominate the political system. It's very difficult for people in the subcultural groups, as we call them, subculture, because the white culture is the dominant, so everything else is sub, whether they're sub or not, really.
And medicine is a white culture.
And medicine is a white culture. And I think problem is that the white culture says we can afford medical insurance. And I wonder if in the kind of the whole white conservative backlash that we're experiencing now, if there's any hope for medical care bills to get through, be passed.
I think there's very little. They've been talking about every year that I've been, since I've been going to medical school and through all my training, and there's never been anything significant in that time. I don't really look for it this year.
So
I'm hopeful that maybe Senator Long's catastrophe thing will come through, because I think there is a real need, and I think that would help a real segment of our society. That 5%
will always have more doctors
people.
Than Watts.
What?
Beverly Hills will always have more doctors per person.
That's right. but she made a good point here about medicine being a white culture, and I think this is, you know, the black community doesn't want to submit themselves to that white culture in terms of what that white culture recommends as the best medical care for them. And I think that goes back to our infant mortality and our lack of prenatal care. Those are not priorities in that particular culture. They have a lot of midwives in the city of Houston, Texas, and there were lots and lots of babies delivered at home under what we would think would be very atrocious conditions, you and I. And it was only when the midwife got in trouble was that mother and child brought to the hospital for medical care.
Why can't we incorporate some of these alternative methods that what we call the subcultures have been trained and reared with? The knowledge, the background, what we think of as primitive methods of treatment, we've sort of taken these people in under our wing and said, but you're going to go the technical route, you're going to submit yourself to our feeling that things have to be done according to our technology, our science, our system. And why hasn't the medical profession made room for this other means of treatment? The midwifery, I realize, is coming in. But I think that there have been successful alternative ways of dealing with pain and disease that we label primitive and don't accept and shut out, that
could be effective means of dealing with people who can't understand our system.
I agree with what you're saying. I believe it's in Tanzania that they are training what they call barefoot doctors that go out into the villages. And these are people that have had like an eighth grade education, and then they're trained to be able to diagnose by means of a flowchart system what a person needs. And they can administer penicillin, they can do the vaccinations and all that kind of thing, and they know by the way they're trained when they need to refer, and they do the majority of the medical care for the people. And they go out into the villages, and very often they're a person from that village that's gone and gotten the training and then gone back to the other people.
That's what I was talking about before. There's an awful lot of what we pay for in terms of medical service that probably doesn't need a doctor. And in Tanzania, they'd be happy to have any Del Busher who comes through. But in the United States, if you get sick, you want a doctor. That's the way we are. You know, you get sick, or your kid gets sick, and you're not going to recommend your daughter go to a midwife to deliver a baby. You know, you're not.
And that's become a double-edged problem.
Right.
Because when we demand that,
it's our demand.
Also the profession then begins to expect that too. So
that's
we feed
exactly.
And becomes a we.
That's what I'm trying to say. The high cost is part our problem because we have demanded that expertise kind of care, even for a common cold.
But then, right now, where can we go? If we were going to say, I want that alternative system to go to, say, a paraprofessional or whatever, what alternatives do people have right now?
We don't.
We don't, because we haven't built it into the system.
Well, they are, though, a try. Because, for instance, in our small city, we have not been able to keep a doctor, a regular doctor. But now we have a paramedic, isn't he called?
And we have a comprehensive health clinic there.
No.
But he's in contact, of course, all the time with the hospital in our areas, and he refers patients there to them, and he's really
but
a very competent young man.
It's worked out very nicely, you know, not for major, people that feel like they have to have a major operation maybe would go somewhere else. But it really has helped. Now, for instance, a lot of the older people who maybe just need shots or something, well, before they had to find somebody to take them, and that was an expense and everything. So this, I mean, they are trying to do this, I think. To take care of the small places, and it's been a real help.
One of the things that the government, of course, is pushing right now is health maintenance organizations. And they always like to cite the example of Kaiser Permanente, which started this 20-some years ago, and which has an excellent system. But the thing that they don't look at is the fact that Kaiser, all of the people in their system are basically people in good health. And they're not taking a full cross-section of society. They don't have a lot of elderly people or a lot of real young people, and they don't have people who are from the poverty section of our society, which a lot of disease occurs in. So that constrains any kind of system like that. There have been numerous HMOs funded across the country, and if you look at the latest statistics, only about 7 of them have ever been economically successful after 5 years of operation. There was recently one in the city of Tacoma, which closed down, which $5 million had gone into funding this over that period of time, and they were losing something like $40,000 a month at the time when they closed. It was just not feasible. We have one in the city of Spokane right now that's in its second or third year of operation, and recently expanded to have other offices across the city. And I'm not sure whether it's going to go or not. I did play a little bit part in the original planning and setting it up, but then decided not to join it afterward. But I have people come to me and say, I went to the HMO and I've been there 4 times and I have yet to see a doctor. That's their big gripe.
These midwives in Houston, were they certified? Or
no, not certified, they were.
Good.
because I think that would be a problem. You know, I can see what he is saying. On the other hand, I don't want to take my children to someone who has not had to, you know, be checked out to see if they are well informed. Like, for instance, even a paramedic does have to pass a certain amount of testing. It has to be registered. I don't know if it registers the word certified. And a lot of midwives, now in our hospital, we have a great deal of births that are taken care of by midwives, both at home or in the hospital, but they're registered. And I think that's really important. I'd like to see that certificate that they've had the training.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even in this little small town that we live in, she's talked about, we have very, very, very good volunteer fire department. And we have a nice ambulance, and we are getting another one very shortly. But I think there are, when I did a forum here this last week, I think I counted, I think we have 10 on our volunteer fire department now that are EMTs. And they have, I don't mean to tap, but they have done a lot of studying, very, very hard study. And myself even have taken these courses.
How far away are you from more advanced medical care?
Well, we are 30 miles from Grand Coulee Dam and approximately down from Salt Lake, 100 from Spokane.
Mm-hmm.
We're in Coulee City.
Mm-hmm.
But just the fact that we have somebody there before, why, of course, emergencies were taken care of by the ambulance and their crew, if possible, but before, if your child fell or bumped his head severely or something, you had to run him 30 miles, which was an expense that really it wasn't necessary, but you were worried about it. So it seems to me that something like that, if they had more, I don't know.
One thing that I think is going to happen with the trend now in medicine, the shift to primary care, is that we're rapidly catching up with and replacing the older GPs who have died out and quit practice. And I think we're going to have probably within the next 10 years a surplus of primary care doctors. And I think that that's going to be a salvation for your kind of case, because I think that there will be doctors who will go into smaller communities like that, and maybe one community can't support them, but two or three in the area can, and they'll be 2 days in one place, 2 days in another, and 2 days in another. They will not practice in a hospital, but will practice basically outpatient medical care from the office, which can be quite satisfying in itself. And then they will act, in essence, as triage people, and when people need to be hospitalized, they will refer them off to, say, Spokane or some other place for their hospitalization. So I think that, you know, with an abundance of primary care doctors, that we will gradually start maybe setting up this more tiered care, at least on a small scale in the United States.
But isn't the pressure kind of terrifying one person in the community or in three because of the calls?
Yes, it is.
I mean, most docs don't like it because you're in a staff of four.
Yeah.
At least you get some breathing.
Now that is one of the problems. I agree.
With our insurance, our money that are taken care of, how come we have to wait until daytime to get sick? Even though you have the money, you have the means of paying for it.
It seems to me that most of my mothers deliver during the middle of the night, and an awful lot of people get sick at night that I end up running back and forth for.
You have to wait to daytime to get to your social worker and psychiatrist, too, you know, so they're not the only.
Sometimes your minister.
Oh no, ministers are available all the time.
That's why you have to hide.
You know.
It's not like you're saying that still it's doctors that are going to be the primary care, and I guess in complete contrast with the paraprofessional movement, like their community.
Yeah.
My sister's a nurse practitioner in California. Now taking over a lot of things that before were taken care of by doctors.
We're developing, for instance, in this state, medics. Most of them are corpsmen who have served in Vietnam and had a wealth of medical experience over there and taking care of trauma, and we're retraining them and turning them into medics, and they go into a small community, for instance, a community that has one doctor, and they work under his direction. And they see a lot of patients, and they take a lot of night call for him, and they allow him more freedom than he would have formerly had, which really helps to bail him out.
And what happens when they're not Vietnam experience?
Well, then they're using nurses, too.
So that there is going to be more of a thrust towards...
Yes, there is, definitely. There is a thrust in that direction right now.
I'm also curious about if you experience any difference now. You hear a lot more today in the human potential movement and a lot more talk about wellness and whole person treatment. Has that made a positive impact?
I think so, definitely.
Some changes, significant changes in the medical profession?
Yeah.
People's attitudes are beginning to change?
Yeah, I think people are more and more getting the message that they have a big role to determine in their own health. And that's, for instance, some of the things that I hope to talk about next week is preventative medical care. I thought maybe I could just take a second here and talk a little bit about that. How can you get by with our medical system and do it at the least cost to you? Since we're talking about money, you know. My first recommendation is have a primary care physician, whether he be a family physician, an internist, a general internist, an OB-GYN man, whichever one, but have one that you are in contact with and who you have a relationship with. The other thing is see him on a reasonably regular basis. To me, you haven't gained anything when you've gone 20 years without seeing a doctor, and then when you do come in to see him, he diagnoses the fact that you've got severe heart disease or emphysema or cancer. I don't think you've saved any money by going through that type of a feat, and I see this all the time. And it's for the men, it's mostly men who do not avail themselves of medical care. Women are much more likely to. So have a relationship with a primary care physician and see him on a reasonably regular basis. Now, at about 25, let's say that you during the first year of life, we generally recommend seeing a child 4 years to do his well child care, to get all of his immunizations up, to follow his development. After the first year, we want to see that child at least once a year. And that's not that can be for school exams, for sports exams. It can be for just routine colds and these kind of things. But we take measurements and we check things at each one of these visits where we can pick up diseases and problems at a relatively early stage. So it's once a year, up until about the age of 25. And at about 25, you should have your first major physical examination, in which extensive blood work should probably be taken in terms of blood fats, blood counts, things of this nature. And this is a database then for that particular physician who's taking care of you. In the years after 25, up to say 40, seeing the physician on a once-a-year basis for a woman for her routine periodic exam, pelvic breast check, we listen to the heart, lungs, take care of any intercurrent problems. For men, getting in and being checked for whether it's a cold, having your blood pressure checked, your chest listened to, your heart listened to, taking care of any minor problems you have. But at least once a year, seeing them. But that's just for what we call a periodic check. That's not a complete physical examination. One of the big things that's coming out is the other thing that we Americans think that we have to have is a complete physical exam every year to reassure ourselves that we're in excellent health. That's not needed. It's a big waste of money, and we really can't give you that much reassurance that you're in that good of health despite that major examination that we might do if you don't have any symptoms at that particular point when we see you. So see them once a year for that particular visit. Every 5 years after 25 years of age, have another major physical examination in which blood work is done. Okay? This gets you up to, at that rate, every 5 years, up to the age of about 40 years of age. Above 40 is where we begin seeing more significant disease processes coming in, a lot of hypertension, cancers, heart disease, all kinds of problems. So after then, depending upon how your health has been, you may need to be seen more frequently. Like every 2 to 3 years, you may need to have a more major going over in terms of blood work. But I want to emphasize that at least every year you should see your physician for some things so that he can take certain measurements and see and keep up with how you're doing. And then during the years 40 to 60, we go on that more advanced or less time in between major physical exams schedules. And then up at 60 is more of a, this is the time when you're more likely to have more significant problems coming on. And seeing a physician for what we would call, say, an intermediate exam every year and perhaps blood work, depending on what health problems you might have, are indicated. You're talking about diabetes, heart disease, a lot of things at this particular time being very prevalent. Now that's, you know, if you want to total up the amount of dollars spent over the years for that kind of care, sure, it's a lot of money. But it's a lot less, probably, than trying to come in after a catastrophe illness has struck and has gone to spread to great lengths before you try and recover from it and deal with it. It's probably a lot less in savings to you. And also, it's important about the quality of life after a major illness strikes. The hypertensive person who has a stroke, what kind of quality of life does he have, he or she have, when they're paralyzed with an arm or a leg, or can't speak, or don't have use of their bladder and bowels and these kind of things? Would have been far better to have been taken care of at an earlier age. If they had been seen on a regular basis, that blood pressure would have been picked up at an earlier age, and they probably would have been recommended to get on and given medication to taking care of that before we had the stroke, before we had the heart attack, this kind of thing.
Then you're saying that, see, I kind of interested because someday I'm going to get old. I'm only 71 now. So you're saying then that I don't need to, you say I don't need to go to get a full physical. I've been getting a complete physical, top of my head to bottom of my feet, once a year. And it's cost me over $200.
I would say to you that statistics nowadays and studies would show that you don't need that.
Then you're going to say that they can determine that I will have no prostate problem. I don't need to worry about that.
An intermediate exam will check your prostate.
That will do it.
In the intermediate exam, he'll check your prostate, check your heart, lungs. He'll go over your physical exam from top to bottom, but he's not going to run exhaustive laboratory work. You know, that we don't need to reduplicate this laboratory work every year exhaustively. That's where a lot of money goes.
You're saying unless there's some symptom.
Yeah, if he has a symptom, we need to follow up on it and do the appropriate laboratory work to follow up on that particular symptom. But don't just apply the shotgun approach.
But then that's what I wanted to satisfy in my mind.
Yeah.
That a less extensive examination is going to show up the things that bother me. See, I mean that you know you. You feel pretty good, you want to keep on feeling pretty good, and you don't want to take any chances, see? Well, he should know that.
Yeah.
Why don't he? Because he can get $200 instead of $100.
Yeah, but he's getting, he can afford it.
He's getting it in his medical journals, and he's getting it from the politicians, and he's getting the word. We all are, you know.
Next year, you can come to Holden for another 2 weeks with the money you're going to save.
There you go. That's good news.
Maybe we should call it quits for lunch. There's going to be a forum tonight on pain, which I think you'll find real interesting.